God seems to enjoy the New Year's Day. The first month of the year is very, very important to God, for God has chosen the first month of the year, and often the first day of that month, to do some of the most marvelous things that He's ever done. And God has instructed His people in the first month, and often on the first day of the first month, on New Year's Day, to do some of the most significant things in the entire Bible. For example, the waters were dried up after the flood on New Year's Day, according to Genesis chapter 8 and verse 13. God could have let the waters dry on any day, but God had a world that was going to make a new beginning. And so God chose New Year's Day for that new beginning. Did you know that according to Exodus 4, 2, and 17, did you know that God chose New Year's Day for the rearing of the tabernacle? God had given Moses instructions concerning the building and the erecting of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was erected on New Year's Day, the first day of the first month. Now, to be sure, it was not January 1st. The New Year's Day for God's people normally was what would be our April 1st, the month of Nisan, or our April 1st. Sometimes they had New Year's Day celebrations on October 1st. But just as God chose to have the waters dried up on New Year's Day, even so God chose for the erecting of the tabernacle on New Year's Day. When the Israelites had gone into captivity and been there for those many years, the temple had been leveled, the walls had been destroyed, their own beloved city had been ruined. God raised up in Babylon a man to lead in the reconstruction of the temple, and his name was Ezra. Did you know that Ezra left Babylon on New Year's Day? It was the first day of the first month of the year when Ezra came and decided, or God led him, to start his trek toward the land of Canaan and Jerusalem in particular for the rebuilding of the house of God. Did you know that the revival that was started after the temple was erected, that revival was started on New Year's Day? Don't you see how important New Year's Day is to God, and how important the beginning of a new year is to God? If God dried the waters up on New Year's Day, and if God let the tabernacle become erected on New Year's Day, and if Ezra left the land of Babylon to return on New Year's Day, and if the revival after the reconstruction of the temple started on New Year's Day, then don't you think God has a certain affinity for New Year's, and especially the first day of the first month? Did you know in Ezekiel chapter 45, when Ezekiel led in the cleansing of the temple, did you know that cleansing started on New Year's Day? It was on the first day of the first month. Did you know the Passover? The Israelites killed the firstborn in the first month. It was the first month of the year. And the Passover was on the first month of the year. And the crossing of the Red Sea was in the first month of the year. And the Egyptian armies pursuing and being drowned in the Red Sea was on the first in the first month of the year. And the manna that came from heaven came in the first month of the year. And the water that came from the rock in Horeb gushed out for the first time on the first month of the year. And God delivered His people from bondage in the first month of the year. Did you know the Feast of the Unleavened Bread was in the first month of the year? The purging of all the leaven from the house on the first month of the year. And the eating of the Passover lamb in the Feast of Unleavened Bread was in the first month of the year. Did you know that the Israelites crossed over Jordan on the first month of the year? They left Egypt in the first month of the year. They crossed over Jordan 40 years later in the first month of the year. Did you know that that Esther went before King Ahasuerus and begged deliverance for her people in the first month of the year? Did you know that the great events of the Bible, most of the great events of the Bible, took place in the first month of the year? Now, that's the month Nisan. However, periodically, they had their New Year's Day on October the 1st. I have not mentioned one single thing that took place in October, which was in sometimes the first month of the year. I've only mentioned tonight those things that took place in our April, which was the first month of the year. I'm saying God has a certain way of wanting things to begin in the first month of the year. The tabernacle began, first month of the year. Israelites began their journey, first month of the year. They crossed the Red Sea, first month of the year. They began their trek across the Jordan River in the Promised Land, first month of the year. Hezekiah began his revival, the first month of the year. Ezra began his revival, the first month of the year. Now, if that be true, don't you think it pleased God if you'd decide to do something great in that 1979 and make that decision in the first month of the year? In these early days of 1979, don't you think it'd be a wonderful, wonderful thing for you to set yourself some goals and have a vision for what God can do for you? I need a goal for that Sunday school class. I'm saying in January, you say by the grace of God, my class is going to do thus and so. How about saying, I'm going to double my attendance in 1979? How about that? Or how about saying, I'm going to double my bus route in 1979? Or how about saying, I'm going to double my soul winning in 1979? I'm calling every member of First Baptist Church tonight, on the first Sunday night of 1979, to make your goals and have your dreams and have your vision for all that God can do for you and all that you'll do for Him during this year. I've had in these first 7 days of 1979, I've had some great visions. I think, perhaps, the greatest visions that I've had in my ministry during the first week of a new year. I'll tell you, I've been absolutely just chomping at the bits. I'm like a fella about to run a 100-yard dash, wanting to get off the starting block. They've had to shoot the horn of the gun twice for me because I've gotten away too soon. I'm like a rocket at the Cape Canaveral. I want to get launched. I'm ready to go. I want to go to the moon fast as I can. I've got ants in my pants. I'll tell you, I'm like a little boy in school that went out and played and sat down in an ant bed, had ants all inside his britches, and the teacher looked back and said in the classroom, Johnny, you sit still. And Johnny meant to sit still, and Johnny wanted to sit still, but Johnny couldn't sit still. He had ants in his pants, and ants in his pants, not ants, but ants in his pants. A-N-T-S, he had. And the teacher said, sit still, Johnny. And Johnny said, yes, ma'am, I will. But Johnny couldn't because it had ants in his pants. And so finally, the teacher said, sit still, Johnny. And Johnny said, teacher, I can't. There's something going on back here you don't know nothing about. And there's something going on down here you don't know nothing about either. I've got some goals for this year. I've got some dreams for this year that I think the most challenging I've ever had. I'm ready for the spring program to start right now. I mean, boy, I got so many things in my brain. I've my mind is just going. It's just going all the way. It's going thousand directions. I want to do this and this and this and this and this and this and that. I've got more money a year spent right now than you ever have in 1979. And that's what God wants. The Bible says, doesn't it? In Proverbs 29, verse 18, where there is no vision, the people perish. And the best way in the world, First Baptist Church to perish, is have no vision for the future. Oh, what a great 1978. That won't do, bless God, a greater 1979. I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I onward bound. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. Lord, lift me up and let me stand by faith on heaven's table land, a higher plane than I have found. Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. The Bible says in Genesis 37:19, behold, this dreamer cometh. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 3 says, a dream cometh through a multitude of business. In Psalm 126:1, when the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Proverbs, I think it's 29:26, second, says, him that hath a dream, let him tell a dream. And so I'm simply saying, it's time for a new dream. It's time for a new vision. It's time for you to say, I had a good year with my department, but not as good as next year. I'm going to have this many next year. I'm going to go this route next year. I had a good year in my bus route, but that won't do for 1979. Now I'm going to go on and on and on and on. Listen, the devil is still mad, and the devil is still fighting, and our country is still going to hell, and this church still holds a strategic place in America life, and
As First Baptist Church of Hammond go, so goes 10,000 other churches in this country. You go anywhere you want to go in this country, and you just travel. I got another day from Jim Lyons, and he said, "Preacher," he said, "everywhere I go, I see the influence of First Baptist Church of Hammond and the ministry there." Joe Boyd said, "The only sign of revival he sees in America today is the influence of First Baptist Church of Hammond." Now, brethren, the old mother church has got to keep on going. We've got to keep going. We've got to go higher. We've got to work harder. And we've got to, in this first Sunday night of 1979, we've got to make new goals and have new dreams and have new visions. I don't mean just me. I mean you. I mean you men on this platform have got to have new dreams. I mean for the young people's work and the college work and the junior high work and the high school work and the bus ministry's work and the grade school's work and the rescue mission work and the deaf ministry work and the retarded children, sunbeams work and the pathfinders work and the Spanish work and all of our ministries. We've got to have new goals and new dreams and new visions. Tonight I want to reach out and grab you and shake you and say, in God's dear name, for the sake of our country, for the sake of our Savior, for the sake of our children, for the sake of our future, we've got to hear First Baptist Church say, we're going to have a new vision and new dreams. It was Browning who said, a man's reach should always exceed his grasp. It was James Russell Lowell who said, not failure, but low aim is the crime of the day. Somebody has said the is must never catch up with the ought. The is must never catch up with the ought. I recall years ago reading that amazing story about that little boy, skinny, weakling in the grade school. And his little body was, maybe high school, maybe a little skinny fella. And his little arms were like broomsticks. And his little body was not filled out. And everybody picked on him in class. Every day somebody beat him up and pick on him. And one day the little boy came to the teacher and said, "They're picking on me again." And the teacher said, "Son, why don't you buck up?" And the little boy said, "I can't. I'm too skinny and I'm too weak." And the teacher said, "I dare you. I challenge you. Become the strongest boy in the class." He said, "Look, Charles, you ought not to be like this anymore." He said, "Get you some exercises and eat right and exercise right, and I dare you to become the strongest boy in the class." And something snapped in that little boy's mind. And that little boy said to the teacher, "I will become the strongest boy in this class. They'll be sorry they picked on me." That little boy got him some barbells and weights and began to lift those weights. He did exercises, push-ups and sit-ups and isometric exercises. And he worked and he got bigger. And his little arms got big biceps, much like these right here. And he became a mighty man. And that little boy became the strongest man in the class. And nobody in the class could whip that little boy, for he was the strongest boy in the class. His name, Charles Atlas. Charles Atlas, the man who's done more to influence bodybuilding than anybody in our generation or the previous one, was a weakling. But one day, something snapped in his mind. The teacher said, "I dare you." And the boy had a dream. He had a vision. He had a dream, and he had a goal. And he said, "I'll become the strongest boy in the class." I challenge you bus workers tonight to say, in 1979, I'll have a new goal, I'll have a new vision, I'll have a new dream. I read years ago that wonderful story about a man named Charlie Paddock. Charlie Paddock was a track star, 100-yard dash star. In 1928, Charlie Paddock lined up representing the United States of America in the Olympic Games. And the gun went off, and Charlie Paddock got off to a good start, and he won the 100-yard dash championship, which I guess is the most coveted, unless it's the mile run, most coveted gold medal in all the Olympic track and field. And Charlie Paddock came back to America 1928 after that marvelous victory and winning the gold medal. He went to Cleveland, Ohio. He spoke at a high school assembly there. And when he got through speaking and talking about his gold medal, a little skinny black boy walked up and said, "Gee, Mr. Paddock, I sure did like your speech. I'd like to be an Olympic star someday." And Mr. Charlie Paddock looked down and said, "Young man, you can." He said, "No, I couldn't. I'm just a little old skinny black boy, but I couldn't do it." And Charlie Paddock said, "You can." He said, "I challenge you to be the Olympic champion." That little boy had something snap in his mind, and he decided that he was going to have a dream, going to have a vision, going to have a goal. And he practiced, and he exercised, and he ran with a goal. The goal was the Olympic champion. The goal was to represent his country. The goal was to win a gold medal. 1936, that lad lined up, that little skinny boy lined up at the starting blocks, representing the United States of America. And that little lad's name was Jesse Owens, the greatest Olympic star this country has ever known. Even Adolf Hitler stood up and applauded him as he became the greatest hero of Olympic history in the track and field for our nation. Then Jesse Owens, he had a goal. Something snapped up here. He said, I'll do it. There's anybody I don't have any patience with. It's a guy that has no dream. That guy that doesn't want to go to the top. That guy that doesn't want to say, I'll do something big. I'll rise above the usual. I'll rise above the normal. Our country is going to hell tonight because everybody wants to be in the status quo. Nobody wants to do something big. Nobody has any goal. Nobody has any dream. Nobody wants to win. I'm sick and tired of America losing. I'm tired of the hammer and sickle rising above the stars and stripes in Olympic Games, international competition. I'm tired of a little upstart communist godless Cuba defeating the United States of America. I'm tired of losing. I wish God would reach out tonight and grab some of you folks that are satisfied with the mediocre, satisfied with the normal, satisfied with the usual. And I wish, for the grace of God tonight, you'd say, I'll not be normal. I'll be abnormal. I'll not be usual. I'll be unusual. I'll not be average. I'll be above average. And you'd say, I have a goal, a new goal, a new dream, a new challenge. For 1979, I challenge you to do it tonight. Jesse Owens came back from Berlin, Germany, with his gold medals. They had a parade down the middle of Cleveland, Ohio, honoring Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens stopped for a while in the parade toward the end. A little skinny black boy walked up and said, Gee, Mr. Owens, I sure did like the way you did at the Olympic Games. Jesse Owens looked down at that little skinny boy and said, Son, how old are you? And he told him, and he said, I sure would like to be an Olympic champion. I wish I weren't a little skinny black boy. And Jesse Owens recalled what had happened to him in a high school assembly. And Jesse Owens pointed that little skinny fellow and said, Son, you can be Olympic champion. I dare you be Olympic champion. And something snapped in that little boy's mind. And that little boy said, I will. He began to exercise. He ran and exercised and exercised and ran and ran and exercised and exercised and ran. 1948, that little boy was Bones Dillard. And Bones Dillard lined up representing the United States of America in the 100-yard dash. He ran in the first, got to a good start and won the gold medal. All because of Jesse Owens, all because of Charlie Paddock. Little old black boy said, I will! I have a dream! I have a goal! I have a hope! That's what you need tonight. That's what you need tonight. You folks that over Chiefs of the House, I'm not a preacher. I'm not talking about preachers tonight. I'm talking about every single child of God. Every time that department goes down, you ought to cringe on the inside. Somebody said to me, they said, well, you and Dr. Falwell are just competing. Listen, brother, I'm trying to beat everybody. I never have liked second place. I mean it. Now, if a guy beats me, I'll shake his hand on the outside, smile on the outside, but I'll cuss him down in the knee. You say, you're a bad loser. I don't know. Win! Goal! Vision! Do something big! I didn't intend to do this, but I'm going to tell my favorite story because I just loved it. I haven't told it for a long time. This is the sweetest and funniest story of all the stories I tell. And you folks have heard me tell some really funny things. There are some funny things in this building tonight. I went to East Texas Baptist College in Marshall, Texas. We had 200 preacher boys. Now, if you ever heard a thing I've said, this is worth waking up for. We had 200 preacher boys on campus out of 700 students. Every time we had a new student, a preacher boy was supposed to go and greet him. We had a preacher boys club called the preacher boys club. Every time a new student came on campus, it was we'd appoint another preacher boy, and he would go and welcome the new student. And one day, a new student came on campus, and it was my time to go welcome him. So I went over and I said, "Hello, how are you?" And he said, "Fine." I said, "What's your name?" "My name is Jack Hiles." He said, "My name is No." I said, "Your name is what?" "My name is No." I said, "Your name is what?" "My name is No." "Your name is Joe." "Yeah, that what I said. My name is No." I said, "Joe, welcome. What are there?" "Nothing. Land me here." I'm not sure what was wrong with him. Maybe it was hair lip. Maybe he had a cleft palate and that caused him to talk like that. I'm not sure. And that may have been what it was. Or it may have been he was tongue-tied and he talked to maybe that what it was. Maybe he was tongue-tied. Or maybe it was the worst impediment of speech known to mankind, a northern accent. I'm not sure what it was. But he did say, "My name is Joe." I said, "Joe, glad to have you." "Thank you. I'm Nanamian." I said, "Joe, what are you going to study?" He said, "I'm going to none it when the minute drink." I said, "You going to what?" "I'm going to none it when the minute drink." I said, "You going to study for the what?" "The ministry." I said, "The minister." "Yeah, that what I said. I'm going to study for the ministry. I'm going to be a preacher. I'm going to be a preacher." I thought, good night in the morning. How in the world could Joe be a preacher? He can't even talk plainly. But he became the laughing stock of East Texas Baptist College. Joe, we'd ask him. We shouldn't have done it. We'd see him and, "Joe, what you going to be?" "I'm going to be a preacher." Now we should, and we've asked God to forgive us time and time again about that. And Joe, what you studying? "I don't know, I study for the ministry." And one day all of us were gathered around, sort of not making fun of Joe, but well, out loud we weren't. But we had him talking, a great group of preachers. And "Joe, what you going to study?" "I don't study for the ministry." And all of a sudden, the campus queen walked by. I mean, the prettiest girl on campus. The second place gal was no comparison to her. She won every beauty contest on campus and said, "Joe, what you going to be?" "I'm going to be a... I'm going to be a preacher and I'm going to marry her." Oh, we laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. "Hey, old Joe's going to marry the campus queen." And everybody knew Joe didn't have a chance in the world. He couldn't get a date, much less marry the campus queen. Oh, we laughed and we would stop him in the hall. "Joe, who you going to marry?" "I'm marrying the campus queen. That's who I'm going to marry." "And what you going to be?" "Don't be a preacher." "What are you studying?" "Then with the ministry." And, we laughed. One day, Joe said, "Jack, I'm going to ask her for a date." "You going to what?" "I'm going to ask her for a date." "You going to ask her for a date?" "Yeah, that one thing. I'm going to ask her for a date." And I said, "Where are you going to do it?" And he said, now you're on the campus where the path crawled. One path was going from the chapel up to the administration building. One was going from the gymnasium down to the parking place in front. And so I said, you going to ask her for a date?" "Yeah." Soon as chapel's over, he's going to meet her there and ask her for a date. Well, I got a bunch of guys together, preacher boy, and we hid in the bushes. It was sort of a halls of ivy kind of campus, and we hid behind trees and in bushes. We wanted to see old Joe become the laughing stock of the whole school, asking the beauty. Can you imagine? "I want to have a date with you." We want to see her laugh and make fun. So we hid behind the trees and hid in the bushes. And sure enough, here came old Joe and here came the campus queen. And Joe stopped and he bowed like Lord Chesterfield and he said, "May I please have a date with you?" "Joe! Joe! Say that again!" I said, "Yeah, say that again, Joe. May I please have a date with you?" What we didn't know was that Joe had been practicing on that one sentence. He'd gotten in front of the mirror. "May I please have a date with you? May 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 I..." Now he had practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced. Hours became days and days became weeks. Why? Joe had a dream, had a vision. He wanted to marry the campus beauty. He got to where he could say that one sentence and could say it better than anybody on campus could say it. And by the way, that's the only sentence that most of the fellows on campus won't learn to say. She said, "Say that again." And Joe said, May I please have a date with you? She said, Joe, have you been practicing that one sentence just to get a date with me?
Yeah, I've been practicing.
May I please have a date with you? She said, you sure may. And they walked off arm in arm and hand in hand. This was not
Hiles Anderson College.
And that's one dream you can forget, buddy. Forget it. And they walked off hand in hand, arm in arm, while we preacher boys drooled in the bushes. Tonight, Joe is a preacher. He is pastor of a successful church in Texas and is married to the campus queen. Why? He had a vision. He had a dream. Oh, you folks that are satisfied with the status quo. You folks that are satisfied with the usual. You walk in your Sunday school class on Sunday morning, you got the same old five. Why don't you get some ants in your pants? Same old six and seven. Why don't you decide, I'm not going to be usual. I'm not going to be normal. I'm going to do something big in 1979. I like those passages in the Bible that talk about superlatives. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. I like that. I like that one whatsoever. Thy hand findeth to do. Do it with thy might or all thy might. I like that one that says there's nothing too hard for God. I like that one that says we're more than conquerors through him that loved us. I like that one that says with God nothing shall be impossible. I like those Christian people that say I'm not going to be in 79 like I was in 78. I like those that say I'm pressing on. I'm pressing forward. I'm forgetting those things behind me and pressing forward toward the mark of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Now then, God has given us an amazing 1978. At the end of the year, our church had had the best progress on all fronts. I don't mean we broke every record in every area, but you take the whole thing. Sunday school growth, offering increase, baptisms, conversions, attendance in the services, Wednesday night attendance, everything. Put it all together and you'll find that we had by far and away not only the greatest year, but we had the best improvement over the last year than any year this church has had. But I'm not satisfied. Now I know, we can't get together anymore and say we're going to be number in the top 10 in America. I can recall we got over here and I said, folks, we're going to make the top 10. No reason for First Baptist Church of Hammond not to be in the top 10. And we worked and worked and worked and made the top 10. And I can recall the first year our church became one of the 10 largest Sunday schools in this nation. The thrill and the joy we had. I recall that program several years ago. Our goal was number 6 in 66. Remember that? Be the 6th largest Sunday school in America in 1966. And we made it. By the grace of God, we became in 1966 America's 6th largest Sunday school. I couldn't go to bed at night without seeing Beecham Vick's face. We've got to get higher. I couldn't go to bed at night without seeing Lee Robertson's face. We've got to get higher. I couldn't go to bed at night without seeing Dallas Billings' face. We've got to get higher. And I thought, if I can't get our church bigger, I'll send some discontented folks down there and split their churches. We've got to do something. And then that day came. We became the largest Sunday school in the world. Now for 5 or 6 or 7 years, it's been that way. We have nobody else to overhaul, overcome. Yes, we do. We have our record of last year to overcome. God does not want us to be in the business of trying to beat somebody primarily anyway. God wants us to be in the business of saying we'll do our best. And I charge you and challenge you tonight to say with the grace of God, 1979 in my Sunday school class will be the best year I've ever known. My bus route will rise to new heights. My bus division will rise to new heights. My department will rise to new heights. Whatever I do in this church, I'll do it with all my might. Football season's about over. It reminds me of a story that I tell around the country. I don't tell many of these stories here very much, many of them, because I told them here years gone by. I tell this one around the country, I guess, as much as any story I tell. About 18 years ago, 17, 18 years ago, I was out at O'Hara Field. It was a Monday morning. I was going to Dallas, Texas, to preach at the Galilean Baptist Church for Dr. Bob Keyes. I was late to my airplane and before the new O'Hara terminal was built. It was the old terminal, just a bunch of old rickety hallways with drywall and plywood. And I had a suitcase in one hand, a briefcase in the other. I was late to the plane. I was running down the concourse like this, a hallway to the gate. Looked over, a fellow right beside me was running down the hallway, had a suitcase in one hand, a briefcase in the other. He said, "Hey, are you late for your plane?" I said, "No, sir. I come out here every Monday morning and just run up and down the hall like this, a suitcase. It just makes me feel good." He said, "That's not a very funny answer." And I said, "That wasn't a very smart question either." He said, "What's your name?" I said, "My name is Jack Hiles. What's yours?" He said, "My name is George Allen." He said, "Jack, what do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm pastor of First Baptist Church of Hammond, Indiana." "What do you do for a living?" He said, "I'm assistant coach for Chicago Bears football team." He became coach of Los Angeles Rams, became coach of the Washington Redskins. And we got out of the gate. I got aboard the plane, back in the poor folks section, back in the back. George Allen sat in the first class section. Used to be whites in the front and blacks in the back. Now it's coaches in the front and preachers in the back. And I sat down back there. I sat down the 15th row. Plane was full. I sat down the 15th row. 45 men in front of me. Plane nearly full. 45 men in front of me. We got up to our cruising altitude. Seatbelt sign was turned off and George Allen came through the door. He was looking for me. He stopped the first person up in the front seat and he said, "Are you a Baptist preacher?" Because he didn't get a good look at me because we were going like that, you know, running down there. "Are you a Baptist preacher?" "Well, now, how would you feel if you were on an airplane feeling perfectly normal and somebody insulted you and asked you if you were a Baptist preacher?" You could say, "No, I just have a sour stomach. That's why I look like this." So, fellow said, "No, I'm not." He asked the fellow beside him, "Are you a Baptist preacher?" He said, "No, I'm not." He asked the fellow beside him, "Are you a Baptist preacher?" He said, "No, I'm not." You say, "Did you hear him?" "Yep, I heard him." You say, "Did you know he was looking for you?" "Yep, I knew he was looking for me." "If you could ask him any questions, I'd get along with this sermon." You say, why didn't you tell him you're back there in the back? "Because I was enjoying all the free publicity Baptist preachers were getting, that's why." 45 times I heard him ask that question, "Are you a Baptist preacher?" He came back to me. He said, "Sir, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yes, you may." He said, "Are you a Baptist preacher?" And I said, "Yes, I am." "You the fellow running down the hallway a while ago with a suitcase in one hand, briefcase in the other?" I said, "That's right." He said, "Did you hear me up at the front, walk down this aisle, asking all these people they're Baptist preachers?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Why didn't you tell me you're the one?" I said, "You didn't ask me." He said, "Now, Jack," I gave him 10 demerits for calling me Jack. He said, "Now, Jack," he said, "I'm going to ask you tonight to do something for me besides preach." He said, "I'm going down to Waco, Texas to try to recruit a running back named Ronnie Bull. Ronnie Bull is the best running back in the Southwest Conference. He's the first draft choice for Chicago Bears this year. We've got to get Ronnie Bull." He said, "Now, Ronnie Bull is a Baptist. He's afraid to come to Chicago because he thinks everybody in Chicago is Catholic. And he won't sign with the Bears. He's afraid." He said, "Now, I want you to convince him that Chicago is full of Baptists. Hey, I want him to see a real, live Baptist preacher." And he said, "I believe you and I can recruit Ronnie Bull for the Bears." I said, "George, I'm preaching at Galilean Baptist Church." He said, "No, you're not. Not tonight." He said, "When I get through telling you how big this is, you'll go with me." And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Tonight." He said, "Look, if Ronnie Bull came to Chicago, made all NFL running back, he'd get up on television and testify, and every Catholic in Chicago would become a Baptist." I said, "Man, you're not making sense." He said, "Now, Jack, tonight you're going to go to Waco." I said, "Tonight I'm preaching at First Baptist Church, the Galilean Baptist Church of Dallas." He said, "No, sir, tonight you're going to Waco to help me recruit Ronnie Bull." I said, "George, that's a bunch of bull. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to preach tonight at Galilean Baptist." Listen, I saw that football coach get on his knees. He pleaded. He cried. He preached. He said, "You don't care if Chicago goes to hell." And he said, "Let me tell you something, Reverend." He was standing up and I was sitting down.
He said, when you stand before the judgment bar of God and you see Chicago perish in the fires of hell, the blood of Chicago dripping off your hands because you wouldn't go with me tonight. Listen, that man begged that. Listen, if we had a song, a stanza of justice, I am without one plea, I'd have walked down the aisle that airplane and promised to go to Waco, Texas. Let me tell you, that's why George Allen is a winning coach. That's why he's one of the greatest coaches in the history of the NFL. Why? He has a goal. What he does, he puts his hand to it. He does it with all his might. And that's what we ought to do in the First Baptist Church in 1979. 10 things I want to say right quickly. I want us to do. I realize that most all of these things, don't write them down. You can buy the tape. I need the money. Don't write them down. Many of these things await on the church must vote. I know that. I'm not saying we're going to do them. I'm just telling you what we're going to do. I'm going to leave. That's all. No, I'm not. I'm just telling you. Thank you, Richard. God bless you. If you ever die, I don't know if I'll shout or cry. I may do both. But here's what I want to do. First place, I've been trying to get enough courage to do this for 3 years. I want to have a whole spring program where every Sunday we have more than 20,000 in Sunday school. That's never been done anywhere before. Nothing close. Nobody's ever had over 12,000 in Sunday school outside the First Baptist Church of Hammond. Now next spring, I'll guarantee you that we are going to have a spring program. We're pulling out all the stops. We're going to have every kind of a day under the sun. Beat the devil Sunday, kick your mother-in-law in the teeth Sunday. That'll be a good morning. I'm saying that we are going, get ready for it. Say, superintendents, get ready. Teachers, get ready. Bus workers, get ready. We're going to have some head knocking. And we're going to have 20,000 every Sunday in Sunday school. Then next, this spring, we're going to average in our spring program 25,000 people. Average that. Never under 20,000. Averaging 25,000. Number three, I think it's time that Howells Anderson College went on a recruiting campaign. George Allen can beg folks to come to play football. We can beg folks to come to win souls to Christ. I want us to enroll in Howells Anderson. This will be the twice what our biggest increase has been. But I'm looking forward next year to 2,000 students in Howells Anderson College. 2,000! You say, why? Because I want to get some more heads to knock, that's why. I want to get some more people to say, let's do it! Let's save this country! Let's do something big for God! Let's rise up and set the pace! And these churches can take faith in our church. I mean it. I'm launching a campaign for new students in Howells Anderson College. You don't know it, but you're going to go to college, take a refresher course this year, Brother Ray. Number four. We're going to build, as you know, a new men's dormitory at Howells Anderson College. Number five, before December 31st, 1979, if I've got to dig it, if I've got to sell candy from house to house, you'd like that, wouldn't you? If I've got to get me a monkey, an organ grinder, and have Mr. O'Clair collecting the money in a tin cup, me playing the organ grinder. If I've got to do it, I've got a plan without taking an offering. It's time that we built an indoor swimming pool at our high school. And this year, I'm going to do it. I don't care if I got to dig a hole and stir the concrete with a spoon. I'm going to do all I can. It's time. We did it.
We've built at our college, and we should have. We've given our college new bowling lanes, and I'm glad. But blessed be God, I've been putting off and trying to talk to the deacons about it and ask the deacons to pray about it. And we are going to have something for our high schoolers brand new this year. That isn't all. Number six. Dormitory at the college. 2,000 people at the college. 20,000 in Sunday school every Sunday of the spring program. 25,000 average. That isn't all. Mr. O'Clair has been working for years, saving money. He's got his kids selling candy at the grade school, trying to build a gymnasium. And how much you got saved now? 72,000. It's going to cost about what? 125 to build it? 170. Are we going to build it this year? We're going to build it this year. Have a gymnasium for our grade school. You say, how are you going? I don't know how I'm going to do it. I may get on Fall Wheels Broadcasting and sell giant print Bibles. I may get me a posse and we may intercept the mail truck that comes into his place. I may rob a Brinks truck. I'm going to wait and see if these other guys get caught first. I may find out who's got the biggest insurance policy in the church and shoot you. I'm going to find out how many folks have got you at the church in your will and pray for God to, well, you know. I mean, I just want to, our little kids at the grade school need a gymnasium. They're on. Number seven. Man, I want to get started now. Get your checkbooks out. First time I ever heard Lee Robertson, somebody said, how'd you feel? I said, I heard him. I want to do something. I want to move. I want to run, jump, swim, build a building, burn one, do something. I want our church to do something this year we never had before and should have had. I want us to start a Jolly Sixties Club ministry with our senior citizens. I'm talking about a ministry of a fellowship, a place our senior citizens. Listen, many of these dear ladies, these dear widows, have no place to go for fellowship and recreation except WMS and circle meetings, and that's good. But some of these dear people that are up in years need more activity, more fellowship. I'm going to help Mama get a husband. Mom and Aunt Lou wouldn't speak as long as R.G. Lee was alive. There's no reason why First Baptist Church in Hammond shouldn't have the largest Jolly Sixties Club in the whole country. Activities and excitement and fellowship. Number eight. I want us to, as soon as we can, I want us to turn those apartments out yonder where the boys are having dorms now, as many of them as we can this year, into apartments for senior citizens. As soon as we can. What I'm trying to say is this. God has given me a burden for this year for every facet of our church program, all the way from the little boys and girls in the kindergarten, the gymnasium, all the way to senior citizens' apartments and Jolly Sixties ministry, the college, the high school, the junior high, the grade school, the Sunday school, every phase of our church program. Now we've got you cared for something, a challenge, a goal for everybody from the birth to death. But I want to go farther than that. We're going to build that mausoleum at the cemetery this year. That'll take you after that also. Mr. Depper has his measuring stick. He wants to measure many of you tonight. Number 10 and last. I want us in 1979 to do something I may be in trouble for this, but I have a great burden for the black folks in our country. You know, if America has revival, the black folks have got to be included too. America is rapidly becoming half black, And most all of our big cities have more black folks. Did you know in Chicago, Illinois, our sister city over here, only 20% of the public school students are white? Hear me? We're not going to have revival in America until we have a black revival. This year, I want you to pray very, very much about this. I'd like to start a church in Gary, Indiana. I mean that. I'd like to start a church in Gary and build the biggest church of black folks in the entire United States. I really would. I tell you, it's time we stopped and realized there's somebody here besides us white folks. And it's time we got burdened for these dear black people. And it's time we prayed for God to send a black Lee Robertson or a black Bob Gray or somebody to do something big. And I'd like to see us in 19... Man, I'm just excited right now. I'll tell you what, we may even start a church for maroon people. I don't know. An old black preacher down in Mansfield, Arkansas, was standing on the street corner. He'd just stand up and he'd holler, I don't care! If you is white, you've got to be born again! I don't care! If you is black, you've got to get born again! I don't care if you're maroon. You still got to get born again. I want to start a church for our black friends. I'd like to go to Gary. I mean it. And just find some property there and do something big for God. We're going to reach this area, folks. We've got to reach black folks, too. We've got to do it. Well, you're an integrationist. No, I'm just a Christian. Believes everybody's got a soul. And I believe there ought to be, there's no need in this area not to have the biggest black church in the whole United States of America. I got some black blood in me. Not literally. I was preaching up in Detroit, Michigan, a convention. And I was getting out preached. I was the only white preacher on the program. Everybody's black. And I might add, the first sermon we all preached, I preached the worst sermon of all. Because nobody can preach like those black fellows can preach. Nobody. Now I got an inferiority complex, and I decided to pull out the best sermon I had. I mean, the one that had the most rousements. I mean, the one where I tickled the angels' toes and fluffed their wings. And I decided I was going to close out that thing and show them I was the best black preacher in that building. I got up there, man, I got loose as a goose. I preach, man, I preach. I got to quoting, going down the list, you know. Jesus in Genesis, he's the promised seed. Exodus, he's the Passover lamb. And Leviticus, he's the scapegoat. Numbers, he's the brazen serpent. Deuteronomy, he's the great lawgiver. I got right in the middle of that, and one old black preacher jumped up and said, call a roll, brother, call a roll. I got to cut loose on sin. I wouldn't say this for the world. If a white man said this, he'd be called a racist and there'd be an article in the paper about him the next day. But this colored man said it. I heard him say it. He said it. He jumped right up in the middle of that sermon while I was running and hollering and stomping and spitting and spewing. And he said, woo! Glory to God! He said, man, I'm going to check your ancestry. He said, ain't no man can preach like that without some nigger blood in him somewhere. I didn't say that. He said it. Don't get mad at me. You get mad at your own crowd, buddy. A lot of folks don't know this. When God called me to preach, I thought God wanted me to be a missionary to Africa. I had a burden for the black people. And I've been convicted lately that I try to take 2 engagements a year to our black friends. But I've been convicted lately. Now here I've been sitting in this area. Listen, more black folks live around here than anywhere in America, just about, maybe outside Detroit, Michigan. Here's Gary. Here's South Chicago. We ought to do something about building a great church for those dear friends. We ought to baptize 3,000 black folks in a good old-fashioned soul-winning black church next year. Next year, nothing. This year. Vision. Goal. Do something big. 20,000 in the spring program every Sunday. 25,000 average attendance. 2,000 enrollment in Hiles Anderson College. New men's dormitory. Indoor swimming pool for the high school. Help the grade school get their gymnasium. Start a ministry, the Jolly 60s, senior citizens' apartments, mausoleum at the cemetery, burden for the black folks, 10 things. That's my vision for 1979, and I just can't wait to get started. I just can't wait to get started. It's been a long time since I've told this story. I think it'll fit tonight, and I'll be through. I don't like to tell it. It's a story I use that I'd rather not tell. It's the hardest one I tell outside one other. In my whole ministry and preaching. 34 years ago, last Sunday night, at a quarter of midnight, I felt that God wanted me to preach His gospel. I gave my life to be a gospel preacher. 34 years ago, last Sunday night, New Year's Eve, 1944. There's one thing that I dreaded more than anything else. When I got off my knees, the first thing I thought of is, what will I tell my dad? I never saw a man that hated preachers like my dad hated preachers. I never heard a man curse preachers like my dad cursed preachers. He thought every preacher was a money grabber. He'd have heard my sermon tonight. He'd have been confirmed. Had it confirmed, wouldn't he? No, I don't have any plans of taking any gigantic, big, giant offerings. We may take a few for special occasions, but nothing giant. I have no big plans for that. But my dad hated preachers. And I hated to tell my dad. See, my dad didn't live at home. We met at the corner store or downtown somewhere about once a week, and I spent about 10 minutes with him, wondered why he couldn't come home. New Year's morning. The day of the Cotton Bowl game in Dallas, my dad called me. Said, son, I want to see you. That wasn't unusual. He called me most every weekend or holiday. I said, where shall I meet you, Dad? And Dad said, son, I want to meet you on the corner of Ackard and Commerce Street, one of the main corners, if not the main corner, in Dallas, Texas. At that time, it was the place where the Baker Hotel was located. Catty-cornered across the street was the Adolphus Hotel, and those two hotels housed both the teams in the Cotton Bowl game every New Year's Day. Ackard and Commerce, where they had the riots on New Year's Day, it's where they had the fights, it's where the teams were housed, where they had their bonfires, they had their big rallies, their pep rallies. They closed off that corner, part of New Year's Day. I got on the streetcar, Trinity High streetcar, rode downtown Dallas. I got off on the corner of Ackard and Commerce. On this corner over here was the Baker Hotel. On this corner over here was a bank. On this corner over here was the Adolphus Hotel. On this corner over here was a liquor store, called them package stores. And upstairs, an X-rated kind of a place, a burlesque place. And my dad, being an alcoholic, he told me to meet him in front of that liquor store. It was a red brick building. I got off the streetcar, waited there, and soon my dad stumbled up drunk, New Year's Day. I had to tell him I was going to be a preacher. My dad was a big man, weighed almost twice what I did then. Giant of a man. Dad weighed 235, strongest man I ever met. I've seen Michael Roy, and you won't believe this, but my sister will verify it. Michael Roy, I've seen Michael Roy take a baseball bat, and I've seen my dad flex his stomach like that. And Michael Roy swing that baseball bat as hard as he could at my dad's stomach. I've seen that, Scout's Honor. Honestly, I've seen it. My dad stumbled up, staggered up, drunk. I was standing about that far from the brick of the building. And Dad said, oh, son, Happy New Year. And I said, Dad, I better tell you something before going any farther. Last night, God called me to preach, and I'm going to spend my life being a preacher. I don't think my dad would have done this if he was sober, but he wasn't. He was drunk. He took his big old hands and pushed me like that against my shoulders and pushed me back against the brick building and held me there. He held me so tightly till I could raise my feet and wouldn't have fallen because Dad was holding my shoulders there. And my dad looked at me and he said, my son, being a preacher, he said, a dirty son of a blanking preacher, a dirty money-grabbing blankety-blank son of a blanking preacher. He said, I'd rather see you dead than see you be a preacher! He let me go. I was barely conscious. I crumpled to the sidewalk. A crowd gathered. My dad started walking across the street, Ackard Street, toward the hotel that housed the football team on New Year's Day. He turned around in the middle of the street and walked back. I was lying there weak on the concrete sidewalk outside the liquor store. And my daddy kicked me in the side. He didn't kick me hard enough to break a bone, but hard enough to bruise me. And my daddy said, "My son, a preacher, a dirty blankety blank, son of a blank preacher." He turned to walk away. He screamed, "I'd rather see you dead than be a blankety blankety preacher." He turned, walked across the street. Turned, came back another time. Kicked me in the ribs. Cursed and swore again. And then he heard, hollered so loud that I guess 100 folks around could hear. He said, "Well, I'd rather see you dead than be a preacher, but if you got to be a preacher, I dare you to go out and build the biggest church in the world." About 6 years ago, I stood right there. There's a wall right here. I stood right there. And Dr. Elmer Towns presented me a plaque as being pastor of the world's largest Sunday school. I went to my, after it was all over, I fled to my study. Didn't see anybody. I got on my knees and held the plaque in my hand and I said, "Daddy, Daddy, wherever you are, I did what you said." I never told anybody that story. I told it here, I think, the next Sunday night or soon after. All those years, I had a vision. I had a dream. Behold, this dreamer cometh. I challenge you on the threshold of 1979. Whatever job you have in this church, I challenge you! Give it all you got! Let's make this, for the glory of God and the salvation of sinners and the saving of this country, let's make it the greatest year for Jesus here in this place He's ever had. Let us pray. Oh my God, tonight, it's so easy for our senses to be dulled because of the same old challenges over and over again. Oh my God, tonight it's so easy for us to get adjusted to miracles and victories. I pray you'd help us, oh God, to give it this year exactly what we'd give it if we thought Jesus were coming January 1st, 1980.